us that I might as well mention the stock. Spillers was this one I'm thinking about. It was obvious there was an enormous turnover, and it was obvious that we weren't the only people doing it. So the situation that I have got could be multiplied by three or four. Recipe for disaster. And they, with a bit of luck, occasionally they could scramble out. But Spillers, I think, probably did them in a big way. And they went up to the, I don't know if it was the Old Bailey or not, but there were two or three of them were put up.
Now, you mentioned at one point you ended up picking up the Leader book.
Yeah.
Were you with Aykroyd by this stage, or was it still James Case?
No, it was Aykroyd.
Did you find jobbing leaders, lead stocks, was different to jobbing the food stocks?
Yes, it was, definitely. Well, they were so volatile, and the opposition was far stronger. They had the toughies on the leader books. And Jumbo Wilson, have you ever heard of him? Okay. He was a big fellow, a very good rugby player. He was with Derlacher. He was brilliant. And he was a tough nut to job against.
Could you put a bit of sort of flesh on that? What can you remember particular experiences when you were competing with him?
No, not particular, but I mean generally you knew the lead in the leader positions could change from one firm to another in half an hour. Mm-hmm. If I'd suddenly got something in ICI and Courtauld's, the others hadn't got it, I could run riot and they could do the same. And the thing changed as trade went on. You suddenly thought, you think I've got this absolutely right. And about 10 minutes later, it was absolutely wrong because somebody'd seen something else and I hadn't seen. And there was a reversal of situation.
Mm. Were they very liquid markets? Did you get a lot of two-way business?
Reasonable. But obviously, if you got a bit of news that was very violent news, it would push the leader market up or down violently.
What would you do in that situation?
Try and cover. I mean, reduce your exposure. I mean, just cut and start again. Mm-hmm. The old adage, the first cut is the best cut. You've probably heard that. Mm.
Now, after 2 years of James Case, the merger with Aykroyd was completed. And you'd been running joint books with them previous to...
Yes, but I mean, joint book meant that our losses, as it were, not they were running a book as well. Mm. No, a joint firm thing. I mean, they were gilt jobbers and we were equity jobbers, so that our losses or profits went into their accounts, I suppose, or half of them.
How did you find the merger with Aykroyd? Was it difficult? Were they, particularly coming from the gilt market, different style of people?
Yes, oh yes, yes. They were far more upmarket, shall we say. Mm-hmm. And also some of them were infiltrated into the equity side. Mm-hmm. I don't think any names can be mentioned.
Mm. Is that because it worked or it didn't work? Or?
There was one or two hiccups, put it like that.
Yes, yes. And how was the new merged firm organised?
Well, Ronnie Quirk, who was G.D. Atkin, that's Michael Sargent's ex-firm, was supposed to be head of the equity side. Mm. And obviously Merriman and Pepiot were the gilt specialists, and Leroy Lewis was the boffin. Mm. I mean, Leroy Lewis wasn't a jobber. Mm. He was a brilliant, he got a computer here, not a brain, you know. And tough character. Mm.
Did it make any difference you were jobbing on the floor of the house? Did you have money at your disposal?
We had more money, obviously. Mm. Definitely more money. And I think we were more flexible. The thing had to be put together. There was a lot of dross in the system. A lot of people who really weren't worth their salt. who had to be slowly but surely pensioned off or whatever. You know, some of them were quite elderly people, you know, and they were given early retirement or you know, something happened. And you gradually eliminated, or gradually eliminations happened. And people who showed style as younger people were moved in. And there was a constant assessment, obviously, of the individuals. And as the firm was successful, the Aykroyd firm were very successful, making very reasonable amounts of money, and at times very, very good money. They were in a position to make redundancies, and i.e. be generous in payoffs.
How would you describe Hugh Merriman as a senior partner?
Quite brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. He was, well, you probably know he was a colonel, a young colonel, and he had a tremendous war, and he had a style and a manner about him that was totally different to what you normally meet. For instance, on a Friday, we used to go up to, that's when we were in Moorgate, we used to go up and have a partner's lunch, as it was called, or an executive's lunch, partner's executive's lunch. And so you just carved a bit of meat and sat down. And Hugh Merriman normally arrived at this and would turn up between 1 and 10 past. And we had a little room about this size where we were having a drink or two before lunch. And everybody stood up. I mean, you didn't think, do I have to stand up? You just stood up. And he was absolutely to the point when he was addressing the meetings that we all attended. He was, he didn't mix his words, and he was absolutely straight down the line. He didn't exaggerate. He just put the thing straight down. And he was very, very understanding. Although he was a disciplinarian, he was incredibly understanding, I thought.
Did he have a particular vision for Aykroyd and Smithers?
Oh, undoubtedly, because he started after the war with the firm R.M. Long, who were taken over by Aykroyd. And he obviously, I mean, I don't know whether there was a power struggle, because I wasn't there, but he was soon senior partner. And everybody was backing him. And then he picked out various people. He picked out Brian Pepiot. He picked out Tim Jones, I think. David Lloyd Thomas, have you heard of him?
No, I haven't, actually.
No, he was taken out. I mean, he was a bit on the network, you know, because he was, he was in the Irish Guards, I think it was. And he also, I think he was aide-de-camp to the governor of Jamaica and things like that. So he was, you know, an unusual man, incredible sense of humour, lovely man. And he was picked out, I think. Dick Kimber, I think, was recruited. Did you hear about him?
No. Did Hugh Merriman mix much in the city? Was Aykroyd a well-connected firm?
Yes, very well-connected. I think he was probably rather careful about where he mixed. I mean, he was a gilt man, basically. I mean, he was a guru of the gilt world. And he obviously knew the bank very well. He knew the discount houses very well. He knew Mullins very well. You know, people who were hierarchy in the top firms.
How would you describe Aykroyd now, just before it became a public company? Where did it fit into the hierarchy of jobbing firms?
I would say it was number two then, even then. And I think it overtook Wed Durlacher, definitely. Because Wed Durlacher were, the sons hadn't got the bottle that their fathers had, I think is probably the right way of putting it. Or too much bottle. They hadn't got the metal, I don't think, of some of the original founder members of Durlach and then Wed Durlach.
Now, did you find life with the second or the largest jobbing firm in the stock exchange during the '70s and early '80s was different to life with, say, C.D. Clarke in the early '60s?
Oh, yes, very, very different. I mean, the whole style of it was different. The trading activity was different, and your style of living was different.
Mm. Now, can you elaborate? Well, what was the difference in the trading style?
You had more freedom, although you obviously had to be careful in exposure of money, because you were exposing far more much money, for greater sums. But you had more freedom. Okay, do you want? Supposing you get a big deal in, say, 2.5 million, something or other, you perhaps wander over and to say to Michael Sargent, you know, I've got this one, I think it's right. He says, well, do you think it's right? Yes, well, get on with it. Mm. Now, that was a Hans Andersen fairy story in the old days. Mm. 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 So there was more freedom, but you had to be right, mm. Which obviously you have to be right, and you wouldn't put it up if you didn't think you were right. But you may get a view from somebody you're asking advice from, really, that it's wrong. Mm. Therefore, you wouldn't do it.
How did your career with the firm unfold? You mentioned earlier that you became partner shortly before the firm was listed.
Yeah.
Did you stay on the same jobbing books?
I stayed... yes, I was on the food book. Mm. And then this hiatus happened and on the leader book, and then I moved over to there, and I never went back to foods.
Mm. And did you stay with the leaders the rest of your...
No, I then went on to second line stores and a mixture of things. Another point from my career is that in about, where are we now, 1990, in about 1976-77, I said, the blue buttons we are getting are absolutely useless. Why do we have people in the office interviewing and giving us blue buttons when they don't know the first thing about jobbing? Well, the answer was, you do it. So I did. Mm. And I recruited every blue button from that moment onwards. And there was a team, the three of us, I got two other pals, and I consciously took two people who were different to me and different from the other, you know, the other one. Mm. And their age difference was something up to 10 years. So we all had a different outlook. And we used to sit down and two of us perhaps would start the interview and then you might get somebody back and then the three of us would interview and then we'd get, perhaps we wanted to do a big intake. So we'd get, say, 10 of the most likely ones up, and three of us would sit down and go through them all over a day.
Mm.
And it worked.
Why had the quality deteriorated?
Because, well, I don't think it ever did deteriorate. I think it was always terrible.
Mm.
Because they didn't get the right, you know, they didn't know. You've got a fellow who's running the accounts ledgers interviewing for a job on the floor of the house. I mean, it's a different world. It's chalk and cheese, isn't it?
Well, what did you look for in your...
What was in me?
Mm.
I mean, I knew what I wanted. Mm. I couldn't describe it, but I mean, you're looking at everything. You look at the bloke when he walks in. Practically, you get an experience of seeing the bloke come in, and you know more or less he's okay or he's not okay. And there's the difficult one is the medium one who doesn't come across right, but he might have something, so you have another look at him.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, I mean, we at one point we had 50 trainees, which is a lot of people, mm-hmm. and you had to manipulate them and move them around and mm-hmm. listen to their sob stories and pat them on the back, and mm-hmm. kick them hard, and it worked jolly well actually.
Do you find a company structure was very different to a partnership structure.
Yes, as I mean, as the partnership. Well, the when we changed into public status, I don't think things changed very much. I mean, things were ticked through rather than sit round a table and discuss it. And the really the basic running of the company was done by the top directors who made the decisions and then passed them down. You may get asked what you thought in a particular situation, but not generally. Mm. Fair enough.
And how is this large number of jobbers, all Aykroyd and Smith, actually organised on the floor of the house? Were you divided into departments?
Oh, yes. Each there was a areas, food, chemicals, breweries, you know, you name it. And we had about 35 books, each with their own particular section. And each book, I mean, if, let's say, I know the building book particularly well, there are about 30 leaders. So you had a leader book of 30. And then you've got about 100 and, say, 40 stocks. Well, you can't deal in 100, although they're not active all at the same time. It's too many for one book. So you had two second line books. Mm-hmm. And each book had a number one and a number two. And probably the overall consideration was that each book ran itself and was responsible for itself. And each book had its margins to work on, and each book had to return its P&L regularly, you know, actually, and rules about writing the prices right, and et cetera, et cetera. Discipline in life, in fact.
Did you find, as Aykroyd was one of the two big firms, that there was more pressure on you from brokers to deal in a large size?
Yes, I mean, you know, it's laughable you can't make it in that number. Come on now.
Is that the way you cope with it, or you dealt with it?
Yeah. Well, it depends who it was a bit. Mm-hmm. With you mentioned Peter Rylands. Well, Peter Rylands is a fairly forceful character, and you'd have to negotiate round him, but you wouldn't sort of send him packing, especially as he's Kesner.
Could that be a problem, that particular firms, particular broking firms, would tend to have the orders, and you really wanted to do those orders, and you didn't want to see them going to Wed Durlacher?
Yes, in the main. I mean, some of the ones that you don't do are the best bargains you do.
Mm. Yes, I've heard that.
It depends. You know, you think, thank God I didn't get involved in that one. I mean, you've got to take the rough with the smooth. The end product of what you do is what happens over a half year or a year. Do you make a profit or don't you make a profit? Mm. I mean, and the return on your capital involved is obviously very relevant. Mm. So, and everybody expects you to make a real wrong'un at times, because it's nature that you can't be right all the time. You only hope that the ones who really go wrong aren't the biggest ones. Mm.
By this stage, about how many firms were you competing with?
Which, what?
Say,
19 when? 70,
well, say
80?
During the 70s.
During the 70s. Well, really, you were only basically competing with, say, half a dozen firms on the straightforward UK equity side. Mm.
Did you find that that was adequate competition, or did you feel pressed by the competition from?
No, that's okay. And in fact, I've always said you want really good competition, because it keeps you on your toes and keeps you tense, and you know what's going on. If somebody doesn't know what's going on, and you're making 103.6 and Joe Muggins is making 93.6, one of you is wrong. Because then a broker comes up and says, you're making me 103.6, but they're 93.6 over there. Who's right? Well, you tend to say, yes, I'm right, and you believe you are right. So that bloke is messing your market up. And he's probably not making it if we are making it in a reasonable size, which we should be, he's probably making it in a small size. Therefore, for a small size quote, it's got nothing to do with my quote in 50 or 100 or quarter of a million or whatever. So it, I mean, it doesn't half rock the boat at times.
Did you find yourself taking bigger positions than you would have in the past? Did that ever become a problem in the sense that...
Oh, yes.
Yes. Well, could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, I mean, it's bound to, because one or two are going wrong. Mm. If you, if you've got a few more noughts on the end of the bargain, that's the multiplication, isn't it?
Can you think of any particular examples? Did you, I mean, were you find yourself, well, in a similar position to what, say, Smith Newcourt or Kleinwort recently have, with positions in companies who suddenly find themselves in
Not
trouble?
Me, because we didn't do it then. I mean, this is a fairly new one. I mean, it did happen, but it was a, as far as I'm aware, it's a fairly rare thing to do. But I mean, the size quoted is obviously very relevant to your capacity to finance it and to handle it. And how long have you got to play with? You know, I mean, can you afford to sit on it for a month? You might be dead wrong after 2 weeks and making a hell of a profit after 4 weeks. It's you know, each one has to be gauged separately.
Did you find that spread agreements were things that were beginning to...
There's always been arguments about spreads, and people close them up and widen them out, and and you, I don't know quite what happens now because I've lost touch with it, but the agreements on spreads, there's always somebody who twists it and turns it according to how the state of mind is at the time.
So in effect, even if there may have been a spread agreement, jobbers were
you get round it, can't you? I mean, if you're making 4-6 and the bloke says, I don't like that one, you say, well, they're 5-7 to you, mate. Well, now, that could happen, put it like that. I mean, I don't say it would necessarily happen. Because if he still can't deal, you've what is known as opened him, haven't you? If you can't deal on 4-6 and he can't deal on 5-7, he's trying to sell him at sixpence.
Was this something that you found that was happening a lot?
There is always arguments, always, and always will be. I mean, there's bound to be arguments now. There's always, every time I walk around the trading floor last year, there was always somebody saying, "These bloody, you know, it's doing it again. They don't keep to the agreements." And if you're on screens, there's still less likelihood they keep to an agreement than if you're all standing in a mob together.
What did you feel about the spread agreements? Did you think they were a waste of time?
No, I didn't think they were a waste of time. I think they were probably overdone a bit. I mean, it depends on the state of the market, really. I mean, you want, a jobber actually does need some protection at times, undoubtedly. In violent markets, they need some kind of protection, although your protection is in your own hands. But if you're always worried if you widen the spread out, when to close it up again. Because you've got to close it up again, else you won't see any business. But, I mean, in average conditions, if there's such a thing as an average condition, you can't... I don't think you can lay down the law too much, but the thing is so changeable that you can have a pattern of what you say this is reasonable to do, and if somebody wants to break it, they say, I'm going to break it.
Did put-throughs figure much in your jobbing experience?
Yes.
In what way?
Well, I mean, I've got the number of the rule. There's a rule about put-throughs.
90, I think.
Yes, I haven't got a rule book here. No, I haven't. You can... According to the position on your book, if there's a put-through, you're allowed to cover a bear and take part of the put-through. If there's a put-through and somebody has got a limit at the put-through price, you can't destroy the put-through on that limit. That's the biggest one. So if you're making 100 to 2, and the bloke wants to put through a million, and you've got another buyer at 2, or you think you have, but you haven't got it firm, you can't destroy that bloke's put through, because you can put them through on 1 to 1/2, shall we say. But you've still got a buyer at 2, or potential buyer at 2. Well, now, can you imagine what happens, can't you?
Could you explain for the tape?
Can you justify a put through at 1 to 1/2 in a million if somebody wants to buy 50 at 2? Mm. Well, that's one of the rules. And there's more rows about put through than practically anything else there have been.
Mm. Was there a particular time when there were a lot of rows? Or was it always a problem?
Always, always, always. Mm. Now, I can remember going back to C.D. Clark. I did a put-through. It was my first sort of big trembly job. I did a put-through with the firm who were lodged next door to us in a thing called Bydand Distilleries, in 100,000 shares. And the firm next door went broke, right? So we've bought 100,000, we've sold 100,000. So we ought to be level. But the chap we've sold them to says, oh, no. So we've got 100,000 Bydand, which at whatever it is, a pound, say, which are unsaleable, really, 100,000. So we'll have to take less and less and less. Mm. Well, actually, eventually it went through, but it took about 3 days to clear it. Now, that is another problem of a put through. If you get stranded.
Did this happen during the Aykroyd?
No, this is C.D. Clark.
What I meant was, would you find a similar situation happening?
You could do, yeah. Mm. Mm. Unless they've changed the rules. I don't know if they've changed the rules. Mm.
Did you resent brokers wanting you to do put-throughs?
No, not really. Mm. Provided they were reasonable.
You never felt that they were that they were preventing you from jobbing the stocks the way you'd like?
Well, it depends a bit on the size. It's rather like rigging a market, isn't it? I mean, if somebody's trying to, you know, they're smaller price stocks, if somebody is, say, something between 10 and 15p, and somebody wants to deal in 800,000s, what can you do? There's a market in a fiver or a tenner. You can't do anything. Therefore, if they want to put them through, therefore they put them through down low, because they say, well, they're 10p bid for a fiver or a tenner, how many, what would you bid me for 800,000? And you say, go on, run. Run away, laddie. And then, of course, when they get put through, they're distributed amongst this bloke's clients at a low price. And then they come in and buy them, you see. They want to buy them in the market. They want to buy 100,000. So the price goes up again. And regularly they get the price up. And plonk, you've got that 800,000 in your belt again.
Was there any way of protecting yourself from that?
Yes.
How would you do that?
Argue. Snarl. Mm. Lots of bad language.
Mm. Did that generally work?
Well, I think you've got to be aware of what's going on. So, yes, it would work, because you've got to just dig your toes in and say, I'm not playing that game.
Did you find that clients were breaking large orders down into smaller blocks and coming to the market with different brokers? Was this a major problem?
Yeah, it could be. I mean, that Tesco thing I told you about. Mm.
And did this occur during right up to Big Bang?
Probably. Mm. Yeah, it probably still occurs. Mm.
Now, as jobbers, again, was there any way of you're protecting yourself?
Are you a virgin? Mm. Yes or no? Mm. If you've got, it's simple language, if you've got the right language, the right thoughts, the right language, and you're looking at a bloke, you can say, is this right? Are you a virgin? Mm. And he's got to answer yes or no. Mm. And if he doesn't answer yes or no, you say push.
Were there brokers you simply refused to deal with?
Oh, very few. I mean, I don't think it's a sensible thing to do, really. But you've got to create your stance, haven't they? Just as the broker really has got to create his stance. I mean, if a broker says, "What a so-and-so," and you make him a price, and he just wanders over the road and checks the price, immediately offers it, and you can read the bloke's lips saying, 3-6. And you know he's made him 3-6, and he comes back to you. Well, you know exactly why he's come back to you if you've made 4-7, don't you? And you say, "Sorry, old boy, they're 2-5. You can't do that. Yeah. I mean, you've got to create a... You have got to, as a jobber, you've got to make yourself the best jobber in the stock and the most pleasing personality. Mm. But you haven't got to be weak. You've got to be tough. Pleasantly tough.
Did underwriting figure in your jobbing experience much?
Yes, I mean, one always got underwriting right from the word go. And I think the unwritten law is you never refused it.
What would happen if you did refuse it? Why was there an?
Well, you wouldn't get any more from the bloke. I mean, underwriting is quite. You're bound to get one that's very touchy. I mean, I see this electricity thing as being. They're asking for a cover from the government, aren't they?